Hello and welcome. It's been a week that's seen a US presidential debate take place again. The last 90 minutes cost President Biden his job. This time, it started with niceties, an extended handshake from Kamala Harris. It's become known as the power move handshake. Look it up on TikTok, I promise you. Let's have fun, said Donald Trump. And if they didn't, we did. News lines emerged that would make the satirical Onion website proud. Immigrants are eating dogs and cats in Springfield, read one. Then one very famous self-styled childless cat lady set out her stall too. Has Tuesday night altered the race to the White House?
You will see during the course of his rallies, he talks about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. He will talk about windmills cause cancer. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom.
She doesn't have a plan. She copied Biden's plan. And it's like four sentences, like run, spot, run.
And it's been a week that's seen a world first, a non-professional crew carry out a spacewalk 700 kilometers above Earth, orbiting at a higher altitude than any mission for 5 decades. US billionaire Jared Isaacman and SpaceX engineer Sarah Gillis took on what's considered to be one of the riskiest maneuvers, and Isaacman had clearly been rehearsing his speech.
Back at home, we all have a lot of work to do, but from here, Earth sure looks like a perfect world.
And it turns out rock stars can be lifesavers. This week, Nashville police crediting John Bon Jovi for saving a woman's life by talking her down from a ledge of a bridge on Tuesday night. So we'll be asking the correspondents in this often difficult world for their reasons to be cheerful this week. And with me from the press corps this week, joining us from London, David Rennie, the geopolitics editor of The Economist, who is fresh from writing his farewell to Beijing, serving as China's correspondent since 2018, an article he's just written called China's New Age of Swagger and Paranoia. China's also a very big hit for The Economist because he is the co-host of the brilliant Drum Tower that examines everything from party politics to technology. And David, more recently, the dating scene for China's divorcees. Is that right?
That's right. It's a big thing.
More later. Also with us, Vivian Waltz, Paris-based correspondent for Time magazine. First time back with us after the summer break, Vivian. And I know you've been looking at recently counting the cost of the Paris Olympics, looking out the winners and the losses.
Indeed. Well, I think the winners were those who stayed in Paris, actually. I found it totally magic.
Because we had a conversation before, and the other three correspondents in the room said they were leaving, you were staying. And
I'm
you reaped
so
the benefits.
I'm so glad I did. And I've met many who regret that they didn't. So, yes.
Also with us, Mark Burley, foreign correspondent for Agence France-Presse, first joined AFP back in 1997 here in Paris. Oh, an yeah. Interesting, notable year to be here. Since then, Sao Paulo, Tehran. Last time we spoke, you were covering the EU in Brussels. If it's true, the adage from Borgen that in Brussels, no one hears you scream, then you're unleashed with us here in the studio tonight, Mark. And also with us, Celestine Molin, completing the lineup of seasoned reporters. Celestine's former New York Times Moscow correspondent, Budapest bureau chief as well. Celestine, fantastic to have you with us.
Thank you.
Has there been a story this week that has really caught your attention?
Well, in fact, the ones you've chosen. I mean, I think the debate obviously dominated for particularly Americans like me. It took me a day and a half to watch it. In fact, I only finished this afternoon, so that was, you know, interesting. And then I think the Ukraine story, which is at a stage right now, today, in fact, seems to be getting sorted out. And I fear, and we were talking about it earlier, that we may not really know if there's a decision made by the United States to give the green light to use long-range missiles. I think it probably will end up being a fudge.
You've teed this up nicely. Tuesday night, debate night in Philadelphia's National Convention Center, Pennsylvania. A first ever face-to-face encounter between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. 9 weeks before US presidential elections, 9 weeks to move the dial, appeal to voters with polls suggesting, in the much-quoted words of US anchorman Dan Rather, that it's tighter than a too-tight bathing suit on a too-long car ride home from the beach. ABC was the host. 67 million people around the world tune in. TV, still the go-to in a social media age. Well, here are the highlights and the lowlights.
Let's talk about what Donald Trump left us. Donald Trump left us the worst unemployment since the Great Depression. Donald Trump left us the worst public health epidemic in a century. Donald Trump left us the worst attack on our democracy since the Civil War. And what we have done is clean up Donald Trump's mess.
Everything that she believed 3 years ago and 4 years ago is out the window. She's going to my philosophy now. In fact, I was going to send her a MAGA hat. She's gone to my philosophy. But if she ever got elected, she'd change it. And it will be the end of our country. She's a Marxist. Everybody knows she's a Marxist.
You will see during the course of his rallies, he talks about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. He will talk about windmills cause cancer. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom. And I will tell you, the one thing you will not hear him talk about is you.
People don't go to her rallies. There's no reason to go. What they have done to our country by allowing these millions and millions of people to come into our country, and look at what's happening to the towns all over the United States. And a lot of towns don't want to talk. It's not going to be Aurora or Springfield. A lot of towns don't want to talk about it because they're so embarrassed by it. In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
Donald Trump was fired by 81 million people. So let's be clear about that. And clearly he is having a very difficult time processing that. But we cannot afford to have a president of the United States who attempts, as he did in the past, to upend the will of the voters in a free and fair election.
Let me just tell you about world leaders. Viktor Orban, one of the most respected men, they call him a strong man. He's a tough person, smart. Prime Minister of Hungary. They said, why is the whole world blowing up? 3 years ago, it wasn't. Why is it blowing up? He said, because you need Trump back as president. Wait a minute. I'm talking now, if you don't mind, please. Does that sound familiar?
Let's begin with Vivian. Your reflection of the debate is a spectacle and a battle.
Well, one thing you've got to say about Trump is he is entertaining at a dark kind of way. Look, if there were a system in which voters were all kind of logical, clear-thinking people, and there was not this kind of totally baked-in tribalism in the U.S., and if this was a popular vote rather than the Electoral College, there's no question Kamala Harris would be president in 3 months' time. But there isn't any of that. And that, I think, is what is so anxiety-provoking about all of this. It's completely clear who in that debate was making sense and who was rambling and spewing these completely crazy conspiracy theories. But that's not the way Americans vote. And I think what the really dangerous implications for the rest of the world is that this election is on a knife edge. It's completely a dead heat, and that there's really no predicting who is going to win at this point.
Mark, it's interesting what Vivian was saying. If you listen to the popular vote, actually which way it would have gone. If you take any snapshot, even look at the YouTube comments for The World This Week, you'll have 50% of people from the US saying it was absolutely Trump that won, and another saying clearly it was Kamala. And that, I think, tells you about the embedded nature of the voters, doesn't it? I mean, if we have Trump as well saying he won. Clear and simple, he doesn't need a second debate, according to him.
I think America is very strongly based on an entertainment complex, and having a president like that or an ex-president like that is very entertaining to watch. Captures a lot of attention, and which then gets amplified through social media, which Americans are massively into. When you've watched, I don't know, Harrison Ford be president and Independence Day presidents, you know, I think there's an expectation to have a caricature, a cartoon, and Trump fulfills that in some way. But I totally concur with Vivian that it would be nice to sort of see democracy being taken seriously. You're talking about national security, you're talking about taxes, you're talking about people's pets. It's there's some serious issues there that he treats as sound bites, and it's as Europeans, I think we just have this wonderful sense of superiority, and we can sort of look down our nose at it and sort of be very amused by it because it doesn't really affect us, except maybe it will.
Interesting, because at the same time, Celestine, if we look at the debates that have been going on since 1960, and we look at Nixon and we look at JFK, since then, the debates aren't generally remembered, are they, for the politics, the policies? It's about who can say something that is remembered later on. Right. Even what we're talking
about.
Or
how they look.
And how they look.
Right.
Nixon famously looked bad.
Right.
People on the radio
sweating,
said they thought he won. If you watched it, he didn't. Fast forward to, the film star, politician Ronald Reagan, a former actor who looked good, who was dismissing quite sensible policies in the 80s of his adversaries.
Right.
So I just wonder whether you think when we take away from this debate, what are those memorable moments? Does it come down to single quotes?
I mean, I think it comes down to behavior. At the end of the day, Trump just does not behave like a grown-up, let alone a possible world leader. I mean, we're talking about crazy things. I mean, I just find that the most striking, that they're just completely absurd, completely off the wall. And this is being taken seriously because he's a presidential candidate. And that's, I think a big difference with him and other previous debates, which may be high on entertainment and one-liners and, sort of cheap tricks or whatever. But this is something else. And I think it's noteworthy that we're reminded again of this character who is really, abortion after birth.
In a media space that's driven by headlines and driven by, I still want to call it Twitter, X type things that are reduced to just a few words, this is what we end up with. They pander to it.
But again, the things that are lies, that are absurd. He claims that Kamala Harris was negotiating with Putin. She's never met him. At a certain point, the level of falsehoods just becomes staggering and becomes, in a way, its own story. And as in, it just dominates, and it's very hard to refute one by one. So it just gets left as this.
Well, that's an interesting point about refuting one by one, because if you talk about these clips, these moments that are micro moments in social media, one of them was on Donald Trump's website suggesting that he would accept an endorsement from Taylor Swift just a few weeks ago. Now, David, I know you're fresh back from China and now you're taking on geopolitics, but let's talk about Taylor Swift for a moment. Let's have a look at this Instagram post, the Taylor Swift intervention, talking about how she's going to side with Kamala Harris. Several US analysts and my 15-year-old niece tells me we should not underestimate the Swiftie effect on the election. Donald Trump saying it will cost her own supporters. David, what's your take on pop music's most powerful self-proclaimed childless cat lady taking a side?
Well, look, in every election, this is an incredibly close election. And so you can justifiably look at anything that could influence it. It's, basically a 50-50% country. So youth turnout is always a challenge. Young women are a very strong voter bloc for the Democrats and should be a voter bloc for Kamala Harris. So you can assume that anything that gets them to turn out and vote in larger numbers will be a win. But I think just going back to the debate, I think it's important not just to kind of throw our hands up and lament the fact that it looks like show business. This was a tremendous missed opportunity for Donald Trump. Remember that he's got a new opponent. Joe Biden stands down. He's got Kamala Harris. So his one job over this very truncated, shortened election campaign is to define Kamala Harris in the minds of voters who don't know her. And he had the job of trying to define her policies. He should have been talking about inflation, the economy, immigration. The fact that she was able to bait him into talking about how exciting his rallies are, irrelevances like the sort of the conspiracy theory that people, Haitian immigrants, are eating dogs and cats in Springfield, that's all wasted opportunity. And I thought what was really interesting was serious conservative journalists in places like the Wall Street Journal lamenting that he had completely failed to use his time usefully to define her and instead allowed her to bait him and make him look self-obsessed. And so I think, actually, in political terms, this is quite a serious event.
Fox News, I heard, David, in the aftermath, even analysts on that channel saying that actually the moment for Donald Trump, they believe, was the last 5 minutes where he tried to conflate both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, saying they were one of the same person, at one point saying he actually hated Kamala Harris. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, his closing statement contained a line that was the kind of thing you would expect him to say all along, which is, how can you say that you're going to make things better when you've been in office as vice president for 3.5 years? Why haven't you done it to date? What that's really getting at is that the Democrats have a big problem, which is that in opinion polls, a lot of Americans say they think the country is headed in the wrong direction. They're very down on things like the economy. So that should be a recipe for a change election, changing the government that is in office at the moment. But by leaving that to the very last minute and getting distracted with all these irrelevancies, he really failed to land a punch on her, and you saw that he is just pathetically sort of susceptible to being baited with personal insults. And you could see that's why she was taunting him about people being bored at his rallies, taunting him about, you know, the fact that he inherited his wealth, he didn't make it the hard way. I mean, remember that comment that you played in the clip at the beginning where he said, you know, she's a Marxist. Well, that's a perfectly legitimate, you know, piece of campaign rhetoric. But just before that, he said, she's been stealing all of my policies. I should send her a MAGA hat. Well, that's just completely confusing to viewers at home. Is he saying that she supports Trump policies or that she's a Marxist? But he's so keen to take the credit for being the smart person who has policies that he can't resist accusing her of stealing his policies before he remembers that actually he's meant to be accusing her of being a hard left Marxist. So you saw that actually he's a very incompetent campaigner when he is baited. And I thought that was, you know, in such a tight election, we never know how much effect an individual debate can have, but it was certainly a staggering lost opportunity to define Kamala Harris, which is his number one job, given that she's new to the race at the last moment.
Vivian, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, like, framing it as a missed opportunity is maybe giving him a little too much credit. And it just seemed to me like here you were looking at a guy who is kind of in his decline. His brain is kind of scrambled. It was scrambled 9 years ago when he began his presidential campaigns. And it's a lot worse now. And I think there was almost something kind of pathetic about it. You had, the mics muted, which you would have thought would have been to Trump's advantage, turned out to be his disadvantage, because Kamala was just there with all her expressions were like, are you for real? You know, like, what on earth are you talking about? You could read it so plainly on her face. And it drove him kind of nuts. And I think eventually there was the one moment in which she said, you know, the man to the right of me does not have the temperament or the ability to, like, be president. And that was actually a very crucial line, that people were looking at a guy who simply wasn't in shape to be a president. All of that, I think, having said that, basically doesn't matter, because what you're talking about is an election that's going to be won or lost on, like, 50,000 votes, possibly. And I would say 99% of Americans, at least, have already made up their mind about who they're going to vote for.
It is often said that debates don't matter. Then we had the Biden debate, which clearly mattered because he disappeared by the wayside. Does anybody, any of you, David, Celestine, Mark, believe that they do matter in terms of moving the dial or not? Has that gone by the wayside now? It's kind of, it's an effect, it's something to do, but it's perhaps not proven yet as to whether it really does take a candidate towards victory.
I'm still thinking about what David said, and I sort of endorse what he sort of said about defining Kamala Harris, because the one thing that I was really expecting from Trump, which he's been slipping and sliding in the mud about and hasn't been able to do something, is give her an insulting nickname, like he has done to every yeah. other person who has been in his firing line. He has been trying. He's
comrade.
Yeah, he's tried that. I've seen him loop through three or four, and he hasn't stuck with any one of them because none of them
stick. Because nothing's sticking.
So, yeah, what David said was really, you know, struck home for me, that Trump's version of defining someone is an insulting nickname. And I was kind of surprised not to see something him repeating it every 5 minutes, 6 minutes. Sorry, your other question.
I think when we look at Vivian's point about how much debates matter, and it is often said don't. But given that we lost Biden at the last,
in terms of get out the vote, in terms of pushing people to actually go and vote.
Yes, which takes us back to Taylor Swift. We're told something like 500,000 people went through her website to the vote.org to actually have a look for more details. That's not to say they're not already voting, but it moves in terms of, you know, a pop star moment. The other point to raise, and this came up twice, David, at least twice, which is China. And both of the views from the candidates on Beijing, from a President Xi perspective, what's your reading of who he would prefer to deal with?
It's an interesting question. I mean, the line that you hear from Chinese scholars is that they don't like either of them, that they decided that Democrats and Republicans, there's not that much to choose between them. Joe Biden didn't reverse the trade tariffs that Donald Trump put in place on Chinese imports. In fact, Joe Biden has made some of the controls on things like sales of technology to China even stricter. And so there's this line that they don't choose between the two parties. I don't think that's true. I think actually the dilemma for China, and it's a hard one, is do they choose Donald Trump knowing that he is extremely unpredictable, that he could put in place incredibly crippling tariffs on Chinese trade. But the upside is he divides the West, he offends allies, he upsets the Europeans, perhaps he could damage NATO, even leave NATO. He'll be offending vital American allies in Asia, like Japan and South Korea, abandoning potentially allies like the Philippines, potentially not interested in defending Taiwan. All of that, if it damaged the West, if Donald Trump, for example, forced the Ukrainians to surrender and negotiate a bad peace deal with Vladimir Putin on day one, which he sort of hinted he might do, all of that's a huge win for China in terms of damaging the West, damaging America. But the flip side is that they know how unpredictable he is and how severe the consequences could be for their economy. So I think what you can really see is China hoping desperately not to be on the front pages during this election. That's why you see China actually quite quiet at the moment in terms of confronting America. They know that as soon as they are the story in this election, it's going to become a bidding war between the two candidates to prove who is tougher on China.
Yeah, it's a good point. Actually, on the same question for you, Celestine, your time in Moscow, about how Russia will see this. I heard the foreign ministry spokesperson say it's like watching two prize-fighting boxers on the Titanic. Yet whoever wins, it's going to sink in 15 minutes.
No, and it's also interesting that Putin came out with this thing where he said he would support Kamala Harris, which, honestly, I really don't know where that's coming from, if it's sort of a sarcastic, you know, attempt at humor in a way. I mean, I think, to be serious, the fact is that it's the same as in China. Trump is an unpredictable element, and so that's not what they want. I mean, in the sense that they can't count on him to do something that they want. I mean, so I think it's the same kind of thing, just keep out of the middle of it. I mean, not that anybody really wants them to endorse anything anyway, so I think it's sort of a no-winner for them in terms of, you know. But, I mean, yes, they probably are going ahead with sort of a interference campaign, much like they did in 2016, which is just to confuse and divide Americans who are already confused and divided. So, you know, there's going to be, you know, fertile ground there for that kind of operation.
Well, talking of Putin and bringing us to the war in Ukraine, sources from Kyiv suggest President Zelensky's team were watching the US debate closely, though there was no social media comment from the leader, usually a frequent presence on X, an expert in optics. Ukraine's future path would likely take a very different route under Donald Trump, who said if he became president again, he would end the war before his own inauguration day, that he didn't say how and refused to say whether it would end in Ukraine's favour or not. Kamala Harris's message is that Ukraine's defence needs continued support. The implications of not doing that are profound and unthinkable. Well, all this in a week where the US and UK appear closer to allowing Kyiv to use their long-range missiles deep into Russian territory. President Putin warning of a direct war with NATO if it goes ahead. Meanwhile, Ukrainian troops continue to hold their advance of the Russian territory of Kursk. For now, Moscow has launched a counterattack. All this is occupying troops in the Donbass, pushing to take a Ukrainian key strategic town of Pokrovsk. Let's hear from President Zelensky, who said earlier on Friday he wants this deal to go through ASAP.
If the Allies are jointly shooting down missiles and drones in the skies of the Middle East, why is there still no similar decision to jointly shoot down Russian missiles and Shaheds in the skies of Ukraine? And this is not done even when missiles and drones are literally heading for the territory of our neighbors. They're afraid to even say we're working on it. They're just afraid of these words.
Mark, in what way do you think long-range missiles, the allowance from US and UK, could change the conflict?
I think the missiles that they're talking about, the Scalp or the Storm Shadow in Britain, I'm not sure that that would be a game changer at this point. As I understand it, the platform to launch these missiles are from aircraft, which are then vulnerable, and only certain aircraft at a certain amount of time. The more important tactical weapon in this are the ATACMS.
ATACMS, yeah.
Yeah,
which the US are ruling
out. Which are launched from the ground, which the Ukrainians have a lot of the trucks they need to launch these things. These make a difference. I think if we're testing the waters, I can't help but kind of wonder if part of this is kind of like running up a flag, sending a statement that we might do it, and they may well allow the Storm Shadows to be used occasionally from planes, but this is coming at a time that the message is coming out pretty solidly that Iran is contributing missiles to the Russian war effort. So if you've got Russia's hostile arsenal increasing thanks to Iran, it makes kind of sense to be pushing back in some way that maybe won't change the overall balance of the thing, but you've got to do something solid. It also opens up a debate down the track that, as well as the ATACMS, I can never pronounce the word, as well as the ATACMS, much more important, much more lethal are the German Taurus missiles, which Zelensky's been pushing for a long time, because these things fly maybe twice as far as the American and the Franco-British missiles we're talking about. They're much more sophisticated, much more lethal, and Germany just won't hand them over. Those things, I think the together, the American tactical missiles and the Taurus missiles, I think they could have a real tactical effect on the battlefield. The Storm Shadows, not so much.
David, when we listen to President Putin making clear this is a new red line, saying the war between Russia and NATO will begin, we've heard this before clearly. Should we take note?
I think we have to take it seriously. I mean, you're right that several times President Putin has said that actions taken by the Americans and their allies in NATO will be taken as an act of war against Russia and that there'll be terrible consequences. And to date, we haven't seen those consequences. So you could say, okay, well, he's just bluffing. But there is a real problem. There is a real dilemma for the Americans and European allies, which is everyone on the European side, on the NATO side, agrees that Ukraine needs to be allowed to defend itself. It's the victim of an invasion, an act of aggression. But there is also the problem that once you start getting to these long-range missiles, these long-range weapons that Ukraine wants to use to attack targets, airfields, missile batteries, deep inside Russian territory, these are sophisticated missiles that need satellite tracking data, which is coming from NATO, American NATO-owned satellites. There are NATO radar air surveillance planes providing a lot of data just off the coasts of Ukraine and Russia. There are NATO officers on the ground in Ukraine, helping them guide and target these missiles. These are very sophisticated systems. And I'm told by colleagues who cover the war in Ukraine that the truth is that British, French, American special forces and officers are on the ground in Ukraine, and it is getting perilously close to being a co-belligerent. NATO is perilously close to being a co-belligerent against Russia, and that is a not small step. That is a very potentially dangerous step. So although I think, you know, The Economist supports the idea of giving them these long-range weapons to take the fight to sites in Russia that are being used to attack Ukraine, it still looks like an act of self-defense. And that's been the position, for example, of Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, that this is still essentially about giving Ukraine the weapons to defend itself. But these are weapons that are so sophisticated that Ukraine can't use them on its own. It does need really significant help from the British, the French, the Americans, and others. And that does start to get pretty close to a real red line for Russia. So I think we have to take that seriously.
Very interesting on your points about the technology being used and the Western technology. I think that was something that was raised by President Putin, saying that they can only make the targeting of the sites, not with Ukrainian missiles or intelligence and satellites. As you say, it is owned by the West. And this point was countered, I heard, on Friday by Radek Sikorski, the foreign minister of Poland, saying that actually Russia will be relying heavily on Western-owned GPS to target the Ukrainian sites. Vivian, listening to David, he was making the point about bringing Keir Starmer into this conversation, who's in Washington, who's meeting with Joe Biden. Big conversation. There's a lot of pressure on right now with Vladimir Putin's comments, also President Zelensky's comments as well. Do you think we'll get a decision soon? And I ask that because, would it be seen as the Americans taking advice from the Brits and suddenly making an announcement? Or if there's going to be a decision, do you think they'll wait?
I don't think that David might correct me on this, but it seems to me that that it would not bother President Biden to be seen to be taking advice from the Brits. And I don't think it would be seen as that. I think that there's some sort of maybe comfort in having this kind of joint force and not to be seen to be all out there on your own for either of them. I think the more kind of worrying question is, getting back to our previous conversation, is we don't know what this war looks like if Trump wins the election. And that's just, you know, a few months away. It could be a totally different situation, certainly in terms of the way he deals with NATO and the way he deals with support for Ukraine, financial backing for the war. This war began under the Biden administration, and it would be probably an extremely difficult and different situation.
Celestine, what's your take on how long this war is going to continue? We heard Vivian talking about Trump. At one point he says it's going to end it in 24 hours if he's president. Next, before his inauguration day, Kamala Harris would keep to the same beat, it sounds like, with President Biden. Mm-hmm. I heard some analysts saying that actually it's going to continue until President Putin leaves office.
I mean, I think timing here is everything. I mean, and it's not just about the American elections. It's about what kind of a situation Ukraine can find itself in if and when things move to a negotiating table. I mean, I think that there is a little bit of softness in the sense of public statements. Putin has said he's ready to negotiate. About what? We don't know, but you know, that word has come out of his mouth. Kiev has also changed its stance in saying that it wants Russia at the next whatever peace mm-hmm. summit there is. Third factor is that Ukraine is now occupying part of Russia, which obviously it looks to have as a kind of a leverage point in any negotiation. Russia is counterattacking, so maybe that's not as solid as a bargaining chip as we would hope. But I mean, all of these things are playing out in real time. And I think that the election is sort of part of the background. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's really about getting chips on a sort of poker table. Not because we think that Putin is going to concede, but that maybe there'll be pressure in some way that makes him have to, you know, acknowledge the fact that he too cannot have this war go on forever and ever.
Well, with the chips on the negotiating table, it could be that it's China that's doing the mediating. David, there's this Chinese annual military diplomacy summit this week, isn't there? It's oddly named the Promoting Peace for a Shared Future. There's a lot to deconstruct in that name alone. But President Xi reportedly meeting at some point in the near future with President Zelensky. Tell us about Beijing, the mediator.
So Beijing's view is that as the smaller country, it's Ukraine's job to accommodate the great power next door and settle for what it can get. And China's view is that it's, you know, it wants peace tomorrow. Now, if that was a bad peace that involved Ukraine giving up territory, I think China would be happy to live with that, partly because they think that that's just how the world works. Great powers dictate and smaller powers do what they must. But it's also about denying the West a win. China claims to be neutral in this war. It claims to be a peacemaker that just wants to see the suffering stop and blames the Americans, not just for, they would say, starting the war, that's the Chinese line, but also for carrying on the war. They say that the only reason the war is still going on is because America and NATO is supplying Ukraine with weapons. There's no acknowledgement of the fact that, as we heard, the Ukrainian president, President Zelensky, is desperate for more weapons. These are not being imposed on Ukraine by the West. But China's version is that this war should stop tomorrow. It's pretty similar to Donald Trump's version, and that that would involve a loss of territory for Ukraine. And that's about denying the West a win. It's about showing other countries that you can't trust an American promise that America will be there for you if you're in a confrontation with a great power. Why does China care about what's happening on the far side of Europe, the Eurasian landmass? Because it's about China's neighborhood. China wants America's allies in Asia to start to doubt America's resolve, to start to think that you can't trust America to be there if you get into trouble. That's about Taiwan. That's about China's confrontations with Japan and others in East Asia and Southeast Asia and the South China Sea. That's the win for China. And so Ukraine is really a tool for China to try to advance the weapon, to advance the argument that all over the world, America is no longer a reliable superpower. You can't count on it. So when a great power tells you what to do, like China or Russia, you need to just listen because America's not going to save you.
Well, David, talking of superpowers, a tale of the old world and the new world next. How can Europe, or can Europe, catch up and keep up with the US and China in a world increasingly led by digital technology and AI? This week, the tech bros of Silicon Valley were spending their riches on making galactic history, carrying out the first civilian spacewalk 700 kilometers above Earth. Billionaire Jason Isaacman had the honor of being first out. He also bankrolled the whole SpaceX Polaris Dawn mission to test the Dragon capsule and spacesuits. Engineer Sarah Gillis also got a go on one of the riskiest maneuvers in space. Meanwhile, down to Earth in Brussels, on the 13th floor of the Berlaymont building, literally the home and the office of the EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen, as Mark well knows, a stack of papers dropped on her desk. It was a long-awaited report on how the EU can become more competitive, enough to catch up with China and the US. The bottom line, old ways have changed. The EU needs massive financial investment, up to 800 billion a year in euros, for digitalisation, defence and decarbonisation. Now, the author of this report is the former European central banker, Mario Draghi, the head, who's also Italian PM, explained his thinking to the press.
Growth has been slowing down for a long time in Europe, but we've ignored it. But the investment needs that all this entails are massive, to levels last seen in the 60s and the 70s.
David, let's start with you. This is about the innovation gap, and this is a story you have a 3D perspective on, your time in Washington, Beijing, now in Europe. Can Europe catch up in the digital race?
So I was actually a Brussels correspondent for 5 years before I went off to Washington and Beijing. So this is all so painfully familiar, because we had any number of reports about, you know, they call it competitiveness. What they really mean is that the European economy just isn't growing fast enough. And particularly as Europe ages, it needs to grow faster. There was some good stuff in this 400-page report by Mario Draghi. There was some more worrying stuff. So there was stuff that is perfectly sensible, like linking up Europe's electrical grids in more smart ways, making sure that money that goes into research and development, particularly for things like green technologies, rather than every country trying to come up with its own plan. You know, when there's limited money to go around, it's better for Europe to try and plan these things, get more sort of bang for their euro. That's all perfectly sensible. There's a slightly more worrying side to this, which is that the backdrop to this report is that there are plenty of countries, and particularly France, where you're sitting, their vision for rebooting European growth is to tear up some of the free market principles that went into the founding of the European project. The idea that it was wasteful when France poured money into its own favourite local companies to keep factories open, if maybe there was a more efficient, better factory in another country. All of those rules that stopped the French government subsidising French factories, French companies, the German government doing the same, the Spanish doing the same, all of those rules are being challenged as never before. You're seeing European leaders saying it's time for Europe to stop worrying about free markets and competition and the idea of, you know, bidding wars between governments, throwing money at companies, that we're in a fight of our lives against countries like China in particular, and that in that world we need to tear up the old rules and let governments bankroll favoured strategic industries and impose trade barriers against products coming in from places like China. That's a much less free market, free trade vision of Europe than we've seen in the past. And Mario Draghi was sort of half enthusiastic, nodded to the political realities that there's a lot of demand for those kind of policies, but did include some warnings about the right and the wrong way to go down that route. But it was a response to a Europe that is very tempted by trying to compete with the Chinese, with Chinese-style subsidies and barriers to trade.
Vivian, David's referring to some of the issues, 400 pages in this report. One of the issues, I think, that comes up time and time again, the old structures of Europe, they've changed. Geopolitics is different. The digital currency, liquidity of how you get cash, not from the banks, but elsewhere, raising capital has changed. The US, as David said, China doing it much better. And that there kind of has to be, one of the recommendations was a pooling of sovereignty in some ways. So if you're going to have the best at tech, it has to be universities. And therefore, some countries have to lose out and other countries be the tech universities. But we're talking about the EU in crisis to get to that point, aren't we?
Absolutely. And if you look at the US, and also China has very much done this, I mean, the US created what was called DARPA, which was their agency very much tied to the military, which effectively invented GPS, that invented more or less the internet. It was, you know, far-thinking. It was, some ways, visionary. And for several reasons, for several years, people in Europe have been trying to replicate this kind of model. Mm. And it simply has never taken off because it gets very ground down in regulatory bureaucracy. It comes up, it collides with the kind of nationalism that's rising in Europe at a time when it actually needs to go in the reverse direction. And sadly, I mean, what you see, and one of the things in this report, was that one third of unicorns, of startups that whose valuation tip over €1 billion, one third of them relocate to the US. And you're left with just a tiny, tiny handful of tech, real tech giants that are located in the EU. It's not worth it for them. It has a fragmented, over-regulated system in which, you know, wages are less than half of what they are in the US. They can't grow.
Mark, briefly, they can't grow. Has it run out, or is there time to catch up?
Had a look at a lot of analysis at Draghi's report and so on. Dr. Draghi diagnosed the patient perfectly. The remedies he's suggesting, not nearly bold enough. I think if we're going to do it in a very quick strip away, all the extraneous stuff, the Franco-German motor isn't working. The political leaders of both France and Germany, who could do the bold stuff together independently, they don't get on, but also they're on political quicksand, both of them. They're both sinking fast into political quicksand. If we were going to do something bold at a European level, I'm sorry for David, who, you know, is against sort of statist intervention. That is a French model that has created champions like Mistral, which is about the only European AI player that we've got. If we're going to be
Americans. Just saying.
if we're going to be talking about an EU-level champions, there has to be some sort of state direction on this. The last point, just quickly, talking about $800 billion, this has to be through joint funding. Germany's dead against that. Not going to happen. And frankly, that we only had joint borrowing before because of the COVID crisis. I think it'll take another crisis for us to get there in the digital sphere.
Mark, thank you. Well, just some briefly good news story of the week. The John Seigelfeller Bridge, Nashville, Tennessee. John Bon Jovi filming a rock video spots someone standing on the ledge having a moment of crisis, according to the Nashville City Police. And it was John Bon Jovi and his assistant that talked them down. You can take a look at this footage. Often difficult world. I want to briefly ask Celestine, in 20 seconds or more, just slightly, what made your life a little better this week or over the summer? Any uplifting tales to warm the heart before we go?
Well, my choice is a little bit odd because it's about cooperation among scientists to figure out why last September, a year ago, there was a 9-day rumble that was heard around the world by geological people who listen to the Earth. Turns out, just to bring it quickly to the point, that it was a landslide which created a seismic, something called an unidentified seismic object, which is pretty weird.
USO.
Yeah. And they all were working together. There were about 70 and millions of thousands of email messages back and forth. The point I loved was at one point, one of the scientists took a styrofoam little, like a sponge, and tried it out in his bathtub to see whether that would explain why there was this land mass that's melted, I mean, that collapsed under. No, I mean, that's the sad thing. But the good news is that everybody cooperated and came up with an answer.
Right, reasons to be cheerful. Celestine, thank you. Mark and Vivian, we're going to have to go. But by popular demand, we're going to roll it on to next week. We're going to give you an end with some good news stories. David, Rennie as well, thank you for your time in London. We'll be back in 7 days for the world next week.